Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
614, hot, humid, above what you'd expect for June 23rd in New Orleans, but the tropics, as you heard in news just now, quiet through July, so I guess we'll take it. Things are not so quiet in Iran. Lindsay Cohn joins us now, associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College, where she teaches strategy, international security, U.S. foreign policy, and civil-military relations. However, the opinions she's about to express are not those of the U.S. Naval War College. They are of Lindsay Cohn. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm about as well as any of us are.
Tell me what's going on with, for people, you know, look, I spent the weekend in Destin in Florida. A lot of people were concerned with LSU baseball here, and it's fun, you know, to get away and escape and all of that. But on a serious note, tell us what went on with the United States and Iran over the weekend.
So as your listeners probably know, because we spoke about it before, Israel started bombing sites in Iran on the 13th. And then this weekend, Saturday night, the United States sent in stealth bombers and bombed three nuclear sites in Iran, or nuclear program sites in Iran. The press conference the defense secretary and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs held claimed that this was a very, very limited targeted strike and that the United States doesn't intend to do anything else unless Iran retaliates in some way. But Iran is now considering retaliation, and so we are kind of all waiting to see what happens next.
So what would that look like, Iran retaliation against the United States? What could they do?
Well, so Iran has never been a direct threat to the United States in any sort of conventional sense. The threat that Iran poses is primarily to, number one, U.S. personnel and assets in the region. Of course, the United States has a large number of personnel in that region, many of whom, in fact, all of whom are within striking distance of Iran. The other threat they can pose is to international economic interests. So they can block or endanger the Strait of Hormuz, which is where an enormous amount of international oil shipping happens. They can also encourage the Houthis to resume their attacks in the Red Sea. So that is what would send your gas prices up. They can also continue to attack Israel. They can potentially organize or incite terrorist attacks around the world, and that could happen anywhere. So they have a number of options.
Who would also not like to have the Strait of Hormuz closed? Who would be involved in that?
No one wants the Strait of Hormuz closed. However, and I think it, even though Iran is threatening it, I personally think it's unlikely that they will do it simply because it would affect some of their potential friends and allies as well as the United States. So I had the feeling that that is more of a bargaining chip than an actual plan.
A bargaining chip for Iran?
Yes, a bargaining chip for Iran.
But if you don't think they'll do it, and I don't see how much of a bargaining chip it is, Professor, maybe I'm missing something.
No, I mean, it's not much of a bargaining chip. You know, like I said, I can be wrong. They can hope that people will believe them. It depends on how desperate they are, really.
So let's talk about what the United States did. We sent United States planes, correct, from a base where? Go ahead.
In the Midwest, yeah. We sent the planes from Missouri, I believe. So it was actually a very well-conceived plan. We sent about seven B-2 stealth bombers to Iran. They were joined in, I believe, European or Middle Eastern airspace by a number of fighter aircraft who swept the area in front of them so that they wouldn't be targeted by other fighters or by ground defenses. and they dropped a number of these bunker buster bombs that we discussed last time on two Iranian sites. The third Iranian site was hit by Tomahawk missiles from a submarine in the Gulf.
So the bunker buster bombs are the ones that we did not want to give Israel?
Yes, yeah, so we are the only ones who have them. And as we discussed last time, you know, the Israelis very much wanted to get the United States involved in this because the Israelis were fully aware that they alone could not make any real dents in the Iranian nuclear program. The U.S. was the only one that had the ordnance to do that. Now we have dropped that ordnance. We still don't actually know how much damage we did to the sites that we dropped them on. It seems fairly substantial, but Fordow, which is the one that we know the least about, is certainly very, very well guarded against even this kind of bomb. And the Iranians are claiming that they anticipated these strikes and moved everything before they happened anyway. So we simply don't know how much damage we have in fact done.
Do we know what kind of intelligence the United States has on the ground in Iran?
The United States has almost no intelligence on the ground in Iran in terms of human intelligence. Mm. We usually rely on Israeli intelligence for that kind of thing. Of course, we have plenty of satellite-based intelligence and signals intelligence that we can use to see these sites and sort of see behavior on the ground where we can establish patterns and try and figure out what's going on.
I guess I'm trying to figure out what do we do now, but we'll talk about it when we come back with Lindsey Cohn, Associate Professor at the U.S. Naval War College, teaching strategy, international security, U.S. foreign policy, civil-military relations, and we'll try to determine what exactly we did to Iran and their nuclear program, if we know, and when will we know, and what do we do next? 620 Traffic Now, WWO. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Lindsey Cohn, our friend, associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College, where she teaches strategy, international security, U.S. foreign policy, and civil-military relations. These opinions are her own, not those of the War College. So, Professor, do we know what we accomplished with these bombing raids? And do we? I don't know how we get in. If we don't have intelligence on the ground, I don't know how we know if we hit the whatever nuclear facilities they had. And then you factor into that Tulsi Gabbard, who said Iran wasn't pursuing a nuclear weapon or didn't have facilities. And then the president said she was wrong. Take me through all of that, please.
Well, so we are the
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses like Rise Bakery connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
The U.S. military and U.S. intelligence services do have ways of doing battle damage assessment, and they are in that process right now. But I don't think we know, we certainly don't know as of right now what the effects were. And it's going to be very difficult to know that precisely because we didn't actually know very much about the facility at Fordow. We also know that the Iranians stated to the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors that they had built a new facility, but we don't know where it is. So that was not struck. So it is possible that we did a significant amount of physical damage to these sites. We certainly damaged Esfahan, which is the research site. But we don't know how much damage we did. We probably delayed an Iranian nuclear program. As you mentioned, our intelligence assessment, the U.S. intelligence assessment, was that the Iranians were not actively pursuing a nuclear weapon. But the Israeli position and the position of the president and several other people was that the Iranians had not proven that they weren't pursuing a weapon, which, if you remember, was the sort of analogous to the argument at the lead up to the invasion of Iraq. So we don't actually know, and we don't know how much we've delayed it. We've certainly done something. But the problem, and I think you're indicating this, the problem is that we don't have a good sort of end game to this.
That's exactly was my next question. How do we know when this is over?
Yeah, well, so there are several problems here. Number one, the United States and Israel do not seem to have exactly the same goals. The United States is claiming, or most officials in the U.S. are claiming, that we're not aiming at regime change. We're just trying to destroy the nuclear weapons program, which, again, the Iranians claim they didn't have. It was impossible to determine whether they were telling the truth. But the president has just recently said that maybe regime change is what's needed. Israel certainly seems to be aiming at, if not regime change, then sort of crippling the entire country of Iran to the point where they couldn't physically pose a threat at all. And those are different ambitions. And so if you're trying to negotiate a settlement and you have people with different goals, that's going to be very, very difficult to get a settlement out of. And the thing for Iran is that if Iran believes that nothing they can do can make them secure, that no settlement they could reach could actually make them secure, then they have no good reason not to simply keep pursuing a nuclear weapon.
So bottom line, I guess, from what we know now, or do we know, is the United States safer? Is the world a safer place? Is Iran a less dangerous country?
That's very difficult for me to answer. I don't think that it's made any difference to the U.S.'s security. The U.S. was not in danger of an Iranian nuclear weapon. Our interests in the Middle East were potentially in danger. It's very hard to say whether this will make the region safer in the short term or not. In the long term, I think there is simply no question that Iran will try to pursue a nuclear weapon, even if they weren't doing so before. They can see the example of North Korea, which is now an accepted nuclear weapon state, even though everyone kept saying North Korea can never have a nuclear weapon. They can see the example of Libya, which gave up its nuclear program on U.S. guarantees and was then invaded by the United States. I don't think Iran is going to sit down at a table and say, yes, we give up, we'll never try to do this again.
Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time. Lindsay Cohen, Associate Professor, U.S. Naval War College, where she teaches strategy, international security, U.S. foreign policy, and civil-military relations. Of course, her opinions were those of herself and not of the institution where she teaches. We're going to talk to Jeff Palermo when we come back. WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. Exciting weekend for those LSU Tigers. No game tonight. No need for that. They sweep Coastal Carolina and claim their 8th national championship. We'll talk about it more when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. It is 6:45, quarter till 7. What can you say about those LSU Tigers? Hi, Jeff Palermo joins us now, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. How you doing, Jeff?
Oh, good morning, Tommy. How you doing?
I am doing all right. I was kidding around saying instead of the Chanticleers, it should be the Chanticleers shut the heck up and get back in the dugout. I don't think it changed the game at all, but yeah. It was just a bizarre kind of thing, don't you think?
It was bizarre. I think it was bizarre all the way around. I sort of understand what Kevin Schnall was saying, the head coach for Coastal Carolina. The reason why I think on all levels of baseball, even in Major League Baseball, there's just very little tolerance for head coaches or managers in baseball or anybody on the coaching staff to argue balls and strikes. I mean, you can get in a quick little quip here or there. Here it is, though, in the first inning. It's, 97 degrees out, and apparently, there was a lot of chirping going on from Coastal Carolina and some missed pitches that they thought should have been called in their favor. And one of the explanation that Kevin Schnall gave was that he did not hear the warning. It was so loud in the stadium, and one of the reasons why he came out of the dugout was because he could not hear the umpire. And so he wanted to get clarification on why he was warned. But, the guy's been in life. He's been in baseball his life. He probably knows why the umpire is warning him.
Yeah,
or you have to know that. If you're sitting there yelling about whether a pitch was a ball or a strike, and the umpire is looking at you and saying something to you, and it's probably a good chance that you're being warned. But it was a tough situation. It put the umpire in a difficult situation. I don't think he wanted to be, bringing anybody up in the first inning, but at that point, rules are rules, and you can't be arguing. And, he kept coming out and approaching the umpire, and that was it.
So One other thing, when it comes to balls and strikes, umpires don't like it when players, when catchers turn around or or players have anything to say at all either, right? I mean, they don't.
No. And it's not like you can be just completely mute about it, right? You could be, I mean, you can say something. I think it's just where you're repeatedly and probably from the. As you saw Kevin Schnall hold up his hand, and he had three fingers showing, and he said it. He's like, you've missed three pitches so far. And the umpires probably say, man, it's the first inning, and if this is the way it's going to be, I'm just not going to tolerate it.
I'm going to put the kibosh on this right away. Right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Anyway, let's talk about the first game on Saturday. It was a long weekend, but the first game on Saturday night and the performance that LSU got out of their pitching staff.
Well, Cade Anderson was absolutely fantastic. I don't think – I mean, when you win a national championship and you cover a team that's won a national championship, you kind of go back to the storylines at the beginning of the season to, you know, try to piece it all together on what a great run it was. And, you know, Cade Anderson established himself as the Friday night starter – but I don't think anybody could have imagined just how dominant he was going to be. I know one of the things that I said about this 2025 team, it's talented, but I don't know if it has the top-end talent as that 2023 team does, because when you think of Paul Skeens and Dylan Cruz and Tommy White and Trey Morgan and all those guys, I mean, those were some really good players. Well, Cade Anderson emerged as the top pitcher in college baseball. And I don't think anybody could have ever predicted that. I mean, you got to give the guy a lot of credit. His ERA last year against Southeastern Conference hitters was over 20. It was over. I mean, he only had limited opportunities. He couldn't get anybody out in the SEC last year. And for him to become one of the top pitchers in college baseball is gives you a sense of how well this program is identifying talent and then developing talent. That's such a key piece to it all. Nate Yeske, the LSU pitching coach, deserves a lot of credit. And now you're looking at Cade Anderson being a number one pick in the Major League Baseball draft, possibly, just like Paul Skeens was 2 years ago. So just terrific pitching. You only get one run for LSU, but that's all you needed. And you had great defense, too. Michael Braswell, as much as he struggled at the plate, was terrific at third base on Saturday night. So it was a great win, a legendary performance by Cade Anderson.
So when it comes to Sunday, and you got Ianson with the ball doing a great job.
Yeah.
Take me through Sunday.
Well, Sunday, you know, Anthony Ianson, interesting, he gives up two home runs. To a team that doesn't hit a ton of home runs, to the bottom of the order. But the key, when you look at this series and how Coastal Carolina was able to produce offensively, it was they would take advantage of teams walking hitters and hit batsmen and stuff like that. Well, LSU didn't allow many free passes. So Coastal Carolina could never really play its game. And Luis Hernandez is also pretty good at throwing runners out. So there were a lot of things that just – so Coastal Carolina had to play a little long ball to actually score some runs on Sunday, which was something that we weren't anticipating them hitting two home runs in a game. But the fact that Ianson and Chase Shores and Cade Anderson went out and they throw strikes or threw strikes, and that's what they've been doing, you know, in particular Ianson and Anderson all season long, that just really – slows Coastal Carolina's game down. It hurts them because they take advantage of pitchers being wild, and that works in the Sun Belt Conference, but it's not going to work against two of the best pitchers in the country. And Ianson was once again really good. Tough conditions to pitch considering, again, it was hot out and the sun is out, but, man, he did an outstanding job. And once LSU broke through for those four runs in the fourth inning, you had a good feeling that LSU was going to come away with the victory in this one.
Let me take a break. We'll talk about Nate Yeske when we come back. He got a text from Matt Boyd during Saturday night's game, I think it was, in reference to Cade Anderson. And I also want to talk about Skip Burtman and how all this started with LSU. Second only to USC in number of total championships. USC has 12. LSU has 8. The population, the size of Los Angeles, okay, you could see USC, but how does Louisiana get that far up in national championship? 652, 8 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 656 4 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director, talking about those world champion LSU Tigers, the eighth championship, second only to USC, who has 12. Take me back to how we get from there to here and the transformative, I guess, nature of Skip Bertman and how he turned this whole thing around.
Well, I mean, Skip is a master motivator, a guy that certainly is able to see talent, knows the game of baseball very well. Mm-hmm. It was one of those things that I think it was something organic in a way, in that he comes here and there's really not much interest in baseball, and he's got all these ideas, and you know, he just starts kind of building it brick by brick. And he created a powerhouse there in the 1990s with the five national championships. And he got LSU to invest in the program when many other schools were not. And so that helped in the fact that LSU had a leg up over other programs. But, you know, when you see how talented the Southeastern Conference is and how difficult it is, a lot of it is because of what he's done, what he has created, and just the passion that you see for college baseball in the South. A lot of that is what he created. I mean, LSU became the top dogs, and then other programs wanted to get there, right there with LSU, and you've seen the likes of Tennessee and A&M and Texas and all these other schools really try to, you know, win national championships in college baseball. But you know, Skip Bertman's a legendary figure, a Hall of Famer for a reason, because he had a vision and he executed. And I would say Jay Johnson, he has a vision as well. And I think this 2025 team is more of a Jay Johnson team than that 2023 team, because this was a team that was very versatile, that he could plug guys, you know, in a variety of different roles, or put this guy here or put that guy there, and they would come through for him. And 2023, that team just had a lot of, just as I mentioned earlier, just a lot of top end talent and a lot of veteran players too. And this was a team that had to come together quickly. There were only 12 guys left after last year's team lost in the Chapel Hill Regional, because whether it was the Major League Baseball draft or some guys went to go see other opportunities. So two championships in 4 years for Jay Johnson, and I don't think he's stopping there.
Is there a guy out there for the basketball program could achieve similar results?
In the basketball program?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think basketball is a little bit tougher just because of, how players are moving in and out of that. It's hard, really, really hard to build a program in basketball. LSU's got the right guy in baseball. They have a relentless guy, and I would imagine Jay Johnson's on the phone with recruits right now this morning, yep, or will be this morning, and I'm sure he's visiting somebody this weekend. He's not going to stop with just two national championships.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate your time as always. WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. I always get greedy, and then I start thinking about basketball, how to turn that around. We'll talk to Joseph Stagney about airport drainage when we come back. WWL.
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.